Sunrise, November the 28th, 1943. My diary. Did the same today as we did yesterday. Very cold but sunny. Must buy some silk stockings. Files diary. Leave today at 2 o'clock. We lay in bed long after breakfast. Anything to avoid it. We drive back into Naples, and after half an hour in the Army and Navy Club, we are off back again. Driver Kit Master says, we should be back about, I don't know when. 48 hours? We spent 40 of them at the transit camp, said Griffin. And how long do we spend in naughty Naples? 4 bloody hours. It's all balls. We had absolutely no time for perversions. Well, we can do some on the way back, I said kindly. On the cold, bumpy, muddy ride back, there were no perversions other than a Jimmy Riddle over the tailboard. We arrived at Tiano. There's an almighty hold-up. Long lines of trucks are ahead of us, the drivers outside stamping their feet and banging their hands on the sides to keep warm. Files' diary. We got out and picked oranges and looked at the appalling damage done to the town. An old man excreted in the street with no comment. I don't understand. Files? Picking oranges in midwinter? What had he been drinking? And what's about this crapping in the street with no comment? I mean, what was the old man supposed to say? Olay! Ah, we're off again. Soon the sound of the guns come wafting in. It's pitch black outside, but then it's pitch black inside. We have a choice of two. So, that was Naples, said Fars. I can't believe it. All this switching from civilization back to war. It's hard to get it together. The luminous ends of our cigarettes are dancing in the dark at the back of the truck. One flies out the back as its life ends. Finally, we arrive back home at 8 o'clock and shagged. We make for the cookhouse. After a mess tin of steaming M&V, we turn in. It's a bitter cold night, so I sleep in my battle dress. Outside comes the rat-a-clack squeak of tanks going north to battle. November the 29th, 1943. Wiggy, wiggy! Wiggy, wiggy? My watch says, oh, 500 hours. Wiggy, wiggy, my arsey! Why don't you fucky, wucky, offy, woffy, I say in clear language. Oh, dear, no, it's, oh, God, it's Sergeant King. He says, you are a going up the hoop ye. It's only for 24 hours. Oh, that's just long enough to be killed, I said cheerfully. In Sherwood's Bren carrier, I travel a 15-mile road to Cipriano. At times, we are in full view of Jerry. He doesn't shell us. But you have that feeling that any minute he will, and that's, well, it's like being shelled. How come they pick you, said Sherwood. Well, I wasn't quick enough. Whee! Foul! He spotted us, yelled Sherwood. He drives off the road behind a deserted farmhouse. Whee! Crash! Whee! Crash! 88 shells. Is he going to drop one behind the farm? No. He just goes along the farm. 5 more rounds and then stops. He's waiting for us to come out. There's only one way to find out. Sherwood revs up and then rushes out onto the road. I cringe. Nothing. Soon we are safe behind covering ground. The OP was manned by Bombardier Eddie Edwards and signaller My Brain Hurts Birch, and the lieutenant from 18 Battery, whose name I can't remember, and a face that left an indelible blank in my mind. The trench was in low scrub on forward slopes, interspersed among the infantry, and to our right, an OP from 74th Mediums, which I, Muggins, had to crawl to, linking them up to our phone. At the bottom of the trench, grinning upwards, is Lance Bombardier Ken Carter. Little did I know, I was looking at the man who would one day produce Crossroads. Had I known, I would have killed him there and then. During the night, I spoke to him on the phone. I heard he was putting together a new soldier show. Yes, it's a pantomime, Alibaba. Is it the same cast as Stand Easy? Bigger, much better. About 100. 100, Christ. Who's left to fire the guns? I want it to be really big, West End stuff. The lads must be fed up with all those skinny bloody six-handed dancer shows. You think you'll be allowed to do it? Yes, I've already spoken to Brigadier Rogers.
Ah, but did he speak to you?
Yes.
Another class barrier has fallen. Headlines, Bombardier addresses Brigadier and lives.
Our hushed conversation was terminated by a cluster of German shells. Boom, bang, bing, bang, bing, boom, bang. I suppose it's to keep us awake, said Bombardier Edwards.
Squatting in a trench for hours is hell. The pain at the back of the knees is exquisite. After dark, we stand up to stretch our legs, but they don't get any longer. What we need are detachable legs Mark 1, I said. A heater in the seat of the trousers, a lubrication point at the back of each knee, hollow rubber feet that can be filled with hot water, an electrified nose muff, and a collapsible poe. I agree with all that, Bombardier, said the lieutenant, save for the last mention. I think a poe would make a man lose that wild sense of freedom that he has as he sprays the furries bitterly with a deft hand and a flick of the wrist. The shelling is big stuff, Jerry 150 millimeters. It's falling about 200 yards to our right, where the infantry have some Vickers machine guns. The phone emits a buzz. I snatched up the handset. OP, I whisper.
Come on, post here, said Peddler Palmer. God's gift to ugly women. The line okay, he says?
Yes, it's clear.
Anything happening up there?
A bit of Jerry shelling, that's okay. It's Edwards' breath and feet that's killing us. You bastard, said Edwards. Palmer continues.
It's all quiet back here. Anything up your end?
No, there's nothing at my end.
You dead little bugger, you, he goes.
The shelling stops. Oh, the poor darlings must be tired, said the lieutenant. A burst of heavy dome machine gun fire. A Bren starts to answer back with its laboured chug, 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 chug. Why did the idiot fire back? He was only upsetting Jerry. Christmas was coming. We should be making paper chains and funny hats to hang on the officers. We open our vacuum tube tea. It's now very tannic and burns the tongue, but it's hot. The front goes quiet. A gossamer-thin quilt of light starts to furnish the sky to our east. It grows almost imperceptibly. A lone, very strong, crowing cockerel shrills the air. Silly cunt, said Birch. A soft, lush pink mounts the heavens, and I watch, overawed, as it turns almost crimson, then pales into the lucidity of daylight. Hello? Who's this approaching on his stomach? Sorry I'm late, it says, as it slithers into the trench. Ah! I recognise those brown teeth. It's Thornton, my relief. What a relief. Sherwood's waiting back behind the hill to take you back in his little noddy car. I collect my small pack and crawl back, always conscious that a bloody German might spot me and riddle my arse with metal. But no! I'm safe and riding back in the Bren carrier. It's dodgy along here, said Sherwood. It's your own bloody fault for coming in daylight. Couldn't ever, said Thornton was late seeing the M.O. Excuses, bloody excuses. This bloody army is made up of excuses. Keep moaning, said Sherwood. It's the only way to promotion. Wee bam! Wee bam! It's the same bloody 88 from yesterday. Lucky, he has only spotted us as we come round a hairpin bend and then go out of view. We're not safe yet, said Sherwood. Those bloody things can fire round corners. Ah, but they couldn't. What they could do was wait for you to reappear. And when we did, he would be waiting. Wee bam! Wee bam! Oh, he was getting too close. We'd have to take evasive action. Sherwood pulls the carrier off the road down a very steep gradient. It takes us out of view, but it puts us at a very perilous angle. We wait, listening intently. We know what to do, but it's a terrible trick. You wait for some silly bastard going in the opposite direction. And while Jerry is plastering him, you scoot out the other way. This we did, and some poor bastard in a recce car came by and got the lot, and then, whoosh, the cocky cowards were gone. Back, safe and sound, I collect my breakfast and join the G-truck bivvy. The fire was being rekindled by Vic Nash, fresh from his bed, and looking like the spirit of dawn in his shirt, boots, half a fag, and coughing his lungs up. Oh, they didn't get you then, was his cheery greeting. No, but you're glad to know they nearly did. Well, you could go back again. No, no, they've stopped piecework. Ah, ah! Enter Edgington, a Dixie in one hand, a tea mug in the other. His unlaced boots reveal a late dash from bed to cookhouse. My God, you've got to be quick, he said. Now Files enters, eating and walking. A Milligan, you've just been up the OP, what's it like? Well, darkness is the best time to go, I said. Oh, fuck. They're going up in an hour's time. I'm taking Mr. Walker and the relief party. How far is it? Oh, about 15 miles. A spark from the fire has shot out into Edgington's tea. Oh, well, he says philosophically, you can only improve it. I am now going to kip, as is my just due, I said. What had started as a clear day now became overcast, so I hurried to sleep to avoid it. During that sleep, the big push for Monte Camino was moving to the starting lines. Three divisions. What's this on my bed? A piece of army form blank with a St. Andrew's cross in it. Was this an invitation to a game of Northern Crosses? No. There in a clear hand was the warning. The phantom arsehole strikes again. What had started as a promising day now grew black with clouds. I slept the clock round. That is, I went to sleep in November and woke up in December. December 1st, 1943. Regimental diary. Support fire continued throughout the night. Files diary. The big do begins tonight. My diary. Rain, bloody rain. And on the fifth day, he divided the land from the waters. Not any more he didn't. For now he mixeth the land and the water, and lo, he maketh mud. And he putteth his beloved son, Gunner Milligan, up to his bloody neck in it. Command post very busy all day. Preparations for fire plan for attack at 2200 hours. Ammunition is being dumped by the guns. Through the day, the pile of muddy shells mounts up. Mud is everywhere. Are they going to attack in this weather? Up a mountain? At 2 in the morning? I couldn't help but recall Siegfried Sassoon's World War I poem. He's not a bad bloke, said Harry to Jack, as they hunt their way forward with rifle and pack. But he did for them with his plan of attack. Did that sort of thing still happen? To add to our emotional confusion, we are issued with Christmas Airway letter cards. They have no particular artistic merit, done by a run-of-a-mill artist. Most certainly, I wouldn't let him run my mill. Christmas. It didn't seem possible. Yet somehow the ancient message was still relevant, a bit of a white relevant, and that was the echo of childhood Christmases, still held strong in the memory. That distant happy time had strength. The call of family and close feeling remained indestructible. Hearts and flowers, please. Dee-dee-dee. The truck from Wagon Lines has arrived with Christmas mail. Smiles all round. A parcel from my dear mother. It's sewn up in a cloth wrapping, giving it the appearance of a mummified cat. With jackknife, army for the uses of, I unstitch the parcel. Fruitcake. Mars bars. Holy medals. Holy pictures, cigarettes, holy smoke. We have to double up on command post duties. One signal on the wireless set, one on the telephone, and the tannoys of the guns. Christ, no sleep for us tonight, said Ernie Hart. Ben Wenham is testing the batteries and topping them up with distilled water. Give him a little drinky-poos, he said, talking to himself. The OP party have left. Lieutenant Walker, Bombardier True, James R. Griffin, Pinchback. They've gone in our newly acquired Jeep with a cheese cutter on the bonnet. This was an upright metal bar that was introduced when Jerry Patrol started putting taut thin wires across the road after dark, decapitating the passengers. Long lines of supply mules are heading up the line, kicking, braying, biting their Cypriot handlers, forever leaping out of the way with shouts of ooshy, ooshy! The weather has grounded all flying, and even grounded walking. Though we do hear one lone plane that sounds like a Jerry. It is. He drops some splinter bombs in a graveyard. I think he's losing his nerve, said Lieutenant Pride. Now all is ready for the big do, codenamed Conquer. A sub-gun lets off occasional harassing fire, so the pre-barrage silence is not too obvious. Edging us out with line maintenance signals. Every half hour, a check call comes through from them.
Hello? Night maintenance here. Night okay?
Yes, okay.
Thank fuck.
0200, the barrage starts. After preliminary fire orders are given to the guns, the fire plan takes over, and we just sit and wait for the targets from the OP. There are nearly 1,000 guns savaging the night. 0400, the attack goes in. Like a miracle, the rain stopped just before 0 hour. Is God on our side after all? Now a tale of Gunner Edgington. 'Twas a dark and stormy night, and the monkey truck signallers lay dead asleep. At the soul-shattering hour of 0100 hours, with the gale blowing and rain squalling the tempest-black night, a cry is hurled among the dormant bodies. The OP line is disconnected! Reacting like a Pavlov dog, Edgington rises, dons his boots, and plunges into the night. He follows the wire, falls into a 3-foot muddy stream, but mends the break. At dawn, while we are taking the first tea of the day, a spectre appears at the command post entrance. It's the same height as Edgington. It sounds like Edgington. It is Edgington. From head to foot, it drips with water and mud, overlaid with a fine layer of frost. Two eyes look out from the mud. It groans. Edgington, says Netch. You naughty, naughty boy. I told you never to play with those boys next door. You just wait till your father comes home. Nash is lucky to be alive. December the 2nd, 1943. My diary. Missed breakfast. Oh, sorry, I'm late, Ronnie, I said in a grovelling voice. I didn't get to sleep till late. I'm sorry, Matty, it's all gone. There's some tea left and some bread. Tea and bread? Oh, yum, yum. Can you make the tea as cold as possible and the bread nice and stale? I don't want to get used to luxuries. Ronnie May grinned. I always wondered why a man with such a refined Italian accent ended up cooking. Apparently, he came from a very upper-class family in the jewellery business. He went to Harrow, and but for the war, would have gone to Oxford. He had fallen in love with a working-class girl, and the family frowned on the prospect of marriage. The war had come along, and to prove that he wasn't a snob, he turned down a commission and became a cook. This was all to impress the girl, who then went off and married an officer. I reheated the tea on Spike Dean's promise and toasted the bread on the G-truck fire. Seeing my foodless plight, Dean says, "Would you like something to spread on that bread?" "Oh, crash, yes," I said. "Oh, there's a tin of boot polish in my pack." The utter swine, revenge! I contacted my friend Bombardier Slogger at RHQ. He worked in the Q stores. He in turn phoned Deans at my instructions and said, "Report at once, Deans. There's something for you to collect." Deans joyfully reported and was given an empty boot polish tin and told, "If ever you get some butter, you can keep it in that tin." Checkmate. 10 o'clock, my turn for command post duty. Taking a writing pad and some old newspapers, I walked down the incline, across the small depression, and up the slope. I passed Maria doing a mountain of military laundry. "Buongiorno, Maria!" She smiled and blushed. The innocence of Italian country girls was something to see. Something else was to see the dimples on the back of her stockings as she bent over. "You're 10 minutes late," said Annie Hart. I'll give you a receipt for it," I said. "And if that's not enough, tonight I'll wear a hair shirt studded with hobnails. Okay, now, if you hurry up, you will see the back of Maria's bum." We were all very busy all morning. A total of 587 rounds were fired in support of the Camino battle. On the infantry network, I hear a new map reference. Bear Ass Ridge. How it got its name is hard to conceive. Lieutenant Walker said it was during an attack. The guards had come upon several Jerrys squatting down to have a pony. One would be hard put to it to find a memorial that said, "To the fallen of Bear Ass Ridge." And yet, that was the case. We came to a slack period, so I went slack. I started writing seasonal letters and some poetry, which was crap. I read it to Lieutenant Wright. What do you think of it, sir? I'm afraid, Milligan, I should never think of it, he said. The rain had let up. A weak silver sun strained to make itself felt. Suddenly, from what seems directly above me, comes the roar of an aero engine. Oh, God, are we for it? A long burst of machine gun fire. We all rush out. There are shouts of alarm. Men are running and looking up. There, at about 500 feet, are a squadron of American Kitty Hawks. The leading plane appears to be coming straight for me. I don't understand. I hadn't ordered one. His machine guns are blazing away. A figure hurtles from the cockpit. A parachute mushrooms. The fighter flashes past and hits the ground 100 yards to our left. There's no explosion. So Hollywood have been lying to us. The pilot is floating down onto an adjacent field. Our idiot major appears. "Follow me," he says, as though we were the light brigade. He leads, holding out a pistol. He doesn't run straight for the pilot. No, we follow the track plan. We skirt the edge of the field in Indian file. Pilot is extricating himself from his chute and wondering why we are all circling him. The major bounds up. He points his pistol at a man chewing gum, wearing a red flying jacket with the words "Hank the Yank from Idaho" on the front and a yellow bird on the back inscribed "Flying Eagles." He's taking a cigarette from a packet of Camels. "Hands up! English or German?" says the loony major. The American went purple. "You're fucking lucky I'm anything. It's your trigger-happing fucking akak. Why don't they make up their minds whose fucking side they're on?" The Major was a little taken aback, steadied himself and said, "Consider it a gesture in return for the number of bloody times you bombed us." This was great fun. Christmas, not only fighting Germans, but each other. After being entertained at the officers' mess with a cup of tea, he was whisked away by a USAAF jeep driven by a coloured private wearing a white bowler. Don't ask me why. We waved him goodbye. "Come and crash on us again sometime," we called. Edgerton is stumbling from his cave. "What happened?" he said. "I was riding to Peg." I grabbed his arm dramatically. "Riding to Peg," I echoed. "You missed the crash. Wait, I'll see if I can get him back." They all go across to the remains of the Kitty Hawk, the thieving bastards made towards the wreck with chisels, hacksaws, screwdrivers, and I call out, "Leave a bit for me." Circling the wreck, Edgerton had said, "I wonder if there's anyone underneath." White bends down and shouts, "Is there anyone underneath?" Friday, December the 3rd, 1943. My diary. Pouring rain. Dug a deep drainage ditch around my bivvy to divert the flow of water. G truck now have logs on the fire. Very cozy. Unending brew-ups of tea and coffee. Back on command post duties. Must answer letters. A letter from my mother and father had said that my brother was to go into the RAF. As he ended up as a private in the Ulster Rifles, I was beginning to feel uneasy about my parents' sanity. My father's letters were getting to be a pain in the ass. He seemed obsessed with the idea that I didn't answer your mother's letters. Now, at the time, I thought he might be right, but on checking with my correspondence log, I note that I answered each and every letter. Since then, and down the years to his death, he continued to insist with accusations, so much so that I registered all my letters and stuck all the receipts in a book that I presented to him on his 70th birthday, with the message to Dear Dad, a small token to prove that I answer all Mum's letters. He looked at it and said, "This is a fake, a fake. My memory is the real proof of your laxity in letter writing to your poor mother." He even wrote to all my relatives, asking them to write to me and pressurized me to answer his poor mother's letters. It was a true crisis of mania. He died saying, "Promise you'll write to your mother today." She was standing beside me at the time. My mother's letters were equally a mass of instructions. Pray to St. Patrick and St. Teresa every night. Go to confession and communion every day. Say prayers morning, noon and night. Always wear your scapular medals. Don't swear. Keep your holy pictures in your pockets. How do you go into action? On your knees, praying? For instance, OP officer, target tanks. Yes, sir. Head secular target tanks. Amen. AT-119 charge 4. Yes, sir. AT-119 charge 4. God forgive me for attempting to kill Germans. Angle side, 03 degrees. 03 degrees. Holy Virgin bless these fire orders. Right ranging, right ranging. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. Amen. Fire. December the 5th, 1943, my diary. Rain, gunfire, boredom, homesick, lovesick. These early December cold, rain-soaked days were hanging heavy on us all. The boredom was only alleviated by sheer effort. Off duty, we would foregather at Shea G truck. The consumption of tea was enormous. We had more tea than ammo. For men to return from mud, shells, rain and cold to enter our little den and see a wood fire was great. Rank. Edgington was a linesman, whereas I was a wireless operator. The ratio was that of a navvy and a bank clerk. Edgington's intelligence warranted more than linesman, but his performance in a wireless set during hectic fire orders would have ground the war to a halt. He couldn't do things at anyone else's pace. It had to be his own. He was his own total master. He gets it right, but all in his own time. And you can't do that in war. He squats near the fire, his mug to his lips. Ah, he gasps. Heaven. Heaven, said cryptic voice Nash. You call this bloody heaven? It was a momentary lapse, said Edgington. It's passed off now. I no longer think this is heaven. I'll rephrase it. I think it's fucking hell. Edgington, having just returned from OP line maintenance, tells us there's very little Christmas spirit up there. The season of goodwill is stone dead, and so are half our young men. We stare at the fire in silence. Nash throws his stub into the flames. The saltpeter flares blue. Files uncasing his guitar. "You're going to burn it," said Deans. Files ignores him, but then so did everybody. Attentively he tuned the strings. "Play the Nearness of You," I said. Alf nods. "E flat," he says. We all sing. "It's not the pale moon that excites me, or thrills or delights me." Enter Jam Jar Griffin, the last Philistine. "Oops, sorry, Vicar. Is there a service on?" he says, reverently taking his hat off. "Yes," said Nash, "active fucking service." "Can I join in?" guffaws Jam Jar, taking off his overcoat. "Let me partake of this seasonal red tannic acid tea, and wish my guts the compliment of the season. A real Dickensian Christmas to you all, my lords." Alf Files laughs long at Jam Jar's old-world posturing. "Ark," said Nash, cupping his hand to his ear in fairy-like gesture. "Isn't that an old Dickensian 7.2 gun going off? 'Pon my word, I didn't know Christmas was so near. I mustered a workhouse to put my Christmas pudding in place." Alf starts to play, "I'm dreaming of a white Christmas." All evening, Deans had been in a state of agitation. Finally, "It's no good," he said. "It's no good. I'll have to open it." "Open what?" "Ah, he has a bottle of masala. He's been waiting all night for us to depart, but couldn't wait any longer, and now he had to share it. He consoled himself with a mugful before letting us into it. Tasted like vinegar." "It's corked," I said. "Corked? It's fat," said Eddington. "Let's think of something nice," said Deans. "Are you going anywhere for Christmas?" "Yes," I said. "I'm going to spend a few days in my tent in Italy." "I think I'll take a stroll on my truck. You never know who you might meet," said Files. "Bzzz. Our private phone is going." Deans raises it. "Hello, World War II. Say, G-Truck." He hands me the set. "It's for you. Gunner Hart in the command post is asking me."
"Ugh! Have you knocked off the pencil?"
"No, I haven't. I've got my own."
"Can I borrow it? Otherwise the battery will be out of the war."
In a few minutes he appears covered in mud. "I fell over," he said. I handed him the pencil. "A cup of tea," said Deans. "Oh, just a sip," said Hart. "They're waiting for me to start the war." He took a hasty mouthful. Tiree grinned and spat it out. "A fire one for us," we called after him. "Any special colour?" we heard him say. The drumming of the rain starts in the canvas ceiling. I throw a log on the fire. It reflames. A shower of needleless sparks fly up the chimney, and so it goes on and on and on. December 8, 1943. This day the battle was won. Jerry pulled out, and Monte Camino was ours. I don't think a battle could have been fought under worse conditions. The pace now slackens. I manage a wayside bath and a tin. It's so cold you keep the top half fully dressed while you do the legs, and then vice versa. We are all fed up with being in the same position. Now rumours are flying. We're going home, etc. And the best fun of all, the war is going to be over altogether by Christmas.